ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 23rd of April. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. Stopping the spiralling costs of the National Disability Insurance Scheme was never going to be easy, but the federal government insists major changes must be made to ensure its future. Now, participants and advocates have been given a glimpse of how those cuts will be made. And while some changes have been largely welcomed, others have raised more questions and anxiety. Isabel Masali reports.
For this Perth mother, the NDIS has been incredibly helpful in accessing speech therapy and physio for her daughter who has Down syndrome. But other services have shocked her, like a course that would prepare her daughter for the workforce.
That's a six-day program that's going to cost $20,000. And that surprises me because, you know, I can see that there are kind of courses through TAFE that she may be able to access with some support, and they're virtually free. So I sort of think that once you put an NDIS or NDIA tag to it, the price is inflated.
She concedes the scheme isn't working as intended and wants to see more scrutiny. NDIS Minister Mark Butler hopes to deliver that and more through a range of changes unveiled yesterday. That aims to bring down the scheme's cost from $70 billion to $55 billion by the end of the decade.
There's a range of organisations in this area that have good qualifications and good experience in disability services. Frankly, there's a whole lot of people who have very little background in the area but just think this is a good way to earn some business income.
Alan Fells is the former chair of the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission. These days, he's the chair of Mind Australia, a mental health support provider. He believes the overhaul will cut the growth of the scheme and the costs, but protect the vulnerable.
They're going to crack down on fraudsters and, to a degree, the many unregistered providers while doing their best to do good financial management and yet keep quality supports in the scheme. At the general level, they've got the balance right. We'll have to see how it's implemented, but it looks to be a sensible way forward.
Under the changes, providers will move to a digital payment system so money is better tracked, and the majority of providers must become registered. Ross Joyce from the Australian Federation of Disability Organisations welcomes the targeting of providers trying to game the system, but he's concerned about plans to use standardised assessments of a person's functional capacity instead of just a medical diagnosis to decide if they're eligible. And then there's the removal of an estimated 160,000 participants from the scheme in coming years.
It's a long way to bring that down in terms of the numbers into the scheme. So I suppose some concerns we have there is how that's going to happen. And I think it's really beholden upon the states and territories to lift their game and to provide greater supports for their communities. So for people to come off the scheme, there's got to be somewhere for people to go.
That reduction will include kids with mild to moderate developmental delays and autism shifting onto the Thriving Kids program. But it's unclear who else will be removed. Minister Mark Butler again.
This is work that we will do over the coming months with the support of a technical advisory group and working with the disability community and obviously with states and territories.
He says changes to assessments won't start until 2028.
Isabel Masali reporting there with Naz Campanella. The federal opposition says older Australians will struggle to keep their private health insurance as the government targets them in an effort to rein in the cost of the rebate. As well as the NDIS changes, the Health Minister Mark Butler yesterday announced that people over 65 would no longer get more generous health insurance subsidies than younger Australians. Political reporter Evelyn Manfield has more.
Over 65s on private health insurance are about to be dealt a blow.
The biggest concern is that they'll be forced out of their private health insurance because they can't afford it during this cost of living crisis.
Anne Rustin is the Shadow Minister for Health and Aged Care.
They're going into a time where they're scrimping and saving to keep their private health insurance because they know in the later years of their life they're more likely to draw on the health system. And these are the people that the government is targeting to pay for the mess that they've made of the aged care system.
For more than 20 years, Australians over 65 have been getting a better deal on health insurance than everyone else. A John Howard-era policy Health Minister Mark Butler wants to put a stop to.
In the election environment of 2004, with government coffers frankly reaping the benefits of the China boom, John Howard increased the private health insurance rebate, but only for Australians over 65. In 2026, that's a policy that's harder to defend.
So the exact rebate depends on income, but basically, once you hit 65, you get a more generous deal, in some cases 8% more. Scrapping that, the government says, will affect 3.2 million people who'll have to, on average, pay about $240 extra a year. The minister expects that financial hit could mean 44,000 older Australians ditch their private health insurance.
I understand this won't be a welcome decision for many, but it is the right thing to do to re-establish intergenerational equity in the rebate system and also to free up funding that we need to provide more dignity and more care to older Australians.
But Anne Rustin says there's a good reason older Australians were given special treatment.
We wanted to encourage older Australians to continue to invest in their own healthcare and stay in the private system so that we didn't have the extra burden on the public health system.
Making this change will require legislation to pass Parliament, meaning the opposition's concerns could become a hurdle for Labor. The Greens, for now, are also keeping their cards close to their chest.
So it's certainly a measure that we're open to, but we need to see the detail before we can commit to the legislation.
That's the party's spokesperson for older people, Penny Allman-Payne. Do you think it should be fair, no matter how old you are?
I don't think it's a good idea for the government to be seeking to pit everyday people against each other. The government has a choice here. They can choose to take more money from older people and everyday people, or they can instigate the 25% tax on gas exports.
Taking a whack at the government and gas corporations as an inquiry into a new tax on exports continues.
Evelyn Manfield there. Iran says it seized container ships in the Strait of Hormuz, a significant escalation in the battle for control of the essential shipping waterway. It comes as the status of peace talks between the US and Iran is in limbo. Correspondent Rachel Clayton is in Washington, D.C.
There seems to be a real standoff right now in and around the Strait of Hormuz. So Iran has opened fire on three vessels in the strait and has taken control of two of them. The two that they've taken control of have been transferred to Iranian waters for what Iran is calling an inspection. And it really is quite an escalation. Iran has fired on ships in the past, but it hasn't taken control or seized ships. It has now done so. There are some pictures going around too, showing a number of fast attack boats moving into the strait from Iran. A Liberia-flagged container ship sustained damage to its bridge. That was the third ship after being hit by gunfire northeast of Oman, but managed to continue sailing on. We will need to sort of wait and see what this turns into, but so far we have had word from Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt in the US. She told Fox News today that the seizure of these ships by Iran does not constitute a breach of the ceasefire because the ships were not US or Israeli ships.
So you mentioned the ceasefire. Of course, that is now continuing, even though we don't have negotiations going on because Iran and the US haven't been able to agree on it. So what's the way forward from here?
We were waiting most of today to see if the president was going to speak. He didn't, but we did, as I said, hear from Caroline Leavitt. She has said there's no deadline on when Iran needs to get their proposal together. Take a listen to what she had to say.
Look, I think President Trump ultimately will dictate the timeline, and he will do so when he feels is in the best interest of the United States and the American people.
She also said that the naval blockade is choking Iran's economy and that the capture of the two ships is not something that the president is overly concerned with. But really right now, the two sides are at an impasse and there's no sense of when or how this is really going to be resolved. There were a few headlines around this morning about potential talks for Friday. That could have been possible. That was from the New York Post. But Iran has really dismissed that idea completely. The Iranian president has also been publishing a few statements on social media accusing the US of, quote, endless hypocritical rhetoric. So both sides are really trying to project strength right now, trying to show that they're the ones calling the shots before either of them decide to really sit down at the negotiation table and come up with a plan. But we don't even know when or if that's going to happen. No one is in Pakistan yet, and the security that the Pakistani officials had set up for these talks has been dismantled today. It's also, of course, always difficult to know what's going on in the mind of Donald Trump. We've seen him do these real 180s over the past week, but in recent days, he's been keen to project this message that he's not desperate for a deal. And that is becoming quite tricky to believe here in the US because of what's coming up. So we've got the King Charles and Camilla are arriving in Washington early next week. A few weeks after that, the president goes to China for very important meetings. The midterms are right around the corner. We've got redistricting happening in quite a few states right now in the US. And there is a lot of Republican pressure for the president to renew his focus on Americans and on domestic issues. So there does look like there is pressure for him to wrap this up so that the threat of further escalations of bombing in the Middle East and on Iran isn't hanging over him when all these very important issues and events that are coming up.
Rachel Clayton in Washington there. Meanwhile, Iran's envoy to the UN believes peace talks will happen, but only if the US ends its blockade of Iranian ports. For more, I was joined earlier by Toronto-based Iranian political expert Samira Moyeddin. Samira Moyeddin, thank you very much for speaking with me this morning.
My pleasure.
Is there a sense that the Iranian regime is delaying these peace talks? Is that their approach to this situation currently?
You know, it's hard for me to say exactly what the Iranian government is thinking at this point. But what I can tell you, based on these prior negotiations that have happened, you know, on their end, they think that it's the U.S. who is actually going to attack again because you know, as what they've had negotiations before, it's always been in the middle of negotiations that the U.S. or Israel has bombed Iran. So I'm not sure if it's the Iranians at this point who are, you know, trying to stall. I think they're trying to find out what the real motives of the U.S. are.
If there's that fear of being attacked, what's the ability of the regime to withstand a resumption of U.S. missile strikes?
You know, at this point, the CENTCOM has noted that over the past month, they have bombed 13,000 targets in Iran. That's more than what they did when they were fighting ISIS in the first month in both Iraq and Syria. So that's the level of bombing that Iran has sustained. And for a government like Iran at this point, survival is winning. And I don't see the Iranian government backing down by any stretch of the imagination. You know, they've shown because of the chaos they've caused that they are an economic power that can cause a lot of problems in the world's economy. And, you know, the Strait of Hormuz is really Iran's jugular vein. They're not going to give it up.
Can you give me a sense of what the level of domestic support is for the Iranian government amongst the people? I know communications is difficult, but have you been able to get any gauge of what the level of support is?
You know, there isn't much support there, but you do see, you know, and I come back to this, Iran is a country of 92 million people. It's the size of Western Europe and the 17th largest country in the world. So it's very difficult to say Iranians feel this or that. However, there is a lot of anger towards the government. There's no doubt about that. But even if, let's say, the government has 20 to 25% of the people's support, which is what many analysts say, that's still about 25 million people. And we have witnessed over the past month this rallying around the flag, you know, that perhaps people who may have been angry prior to this war being imposed are now understanding that it is actually Iran that is under attack. It's not just the government. And that really happened when they saw their civilian infrastructures being bombed, their public health centers, hospitals, bridges, universities. These are not military sites. And that was a real wake-up call for a lot of Iranians, I think.
Do you think it's had a bit of a rally around the flag effect, having seen these impacts from the continual US strikes?
Absolutely, it has. You know, it's a good reminder for people to understand that 3,300 Iranian civilians were killed. And because of the 2,000-pound bombs that were used, which have a radius of a football field and a half, thousands and thousands of people's livelihoods, their stores were shattered. You know, I spoke to someone who had a music school, a very successful music school, had nothing to do. It was not a military site, anything. And, you know, he had put his whole life savings into that music school. And it was ruined in an instant. And so people really now are just living with this fear and in this limbo of not knowing whether they should get on with their lives or not, because every other day they're being told, we're going to attack you, you know, we're going to throw your civilization into the dustbin of history. I mean, this is the type of rhetoric and bellicose statements that they're having to try and get on with their lives with.
Samira Moyen, thank you very much for speaking with me this morning.
Thank you very much.
And Samira Moyen is a Toronto-based Iranian political expert. Every Anzac Day, the last post rings out at ceremonies across the country, followed by the words, lest we forget. But bugler Adam Farquharson, whose father was a Vietnam veteran, plays the last post every day. This Anzac Day, he will have played 815 days in a row. He does it at different veterans' graves, wherever he is, after tidying up their final resting place in hopes of bringing them some dignity and respect. Jess Scully with this report.
At the foot of the Snowy Mountains on a cool, drizzly day, the stillness at Tumut Cemetery is cut by the sound of a familiar but stirring tune. Adam Farquharson is here most days, but even the days he's away from his southern New South Wales home, the ritual is the same.
But once I get to the grave, is stand there at attention, play the last post, recite the ode, play Reveille, then I just wander off. A lot of them, it says lest we forget on the bottom of the headstone, and at least I'm not going to forget. If they've had relatives, if they're maybe the last of their line, there's nobody left to come and see them, and I don't want them to be forgotten. Without a life, you don't really know how it's going to go until you finish. It's big pressure, and to get it right, I take it very, very seriously. Certainly better at it than I used to be, and I do this mainly to try and contain the nerves, and it kind of works.
Adam's dad was a cook at Nui Dat, and his grandfather's also served in the armed forces.
It was absolutely terrifying, but being able to play the last post at Dad's and both my grandfather's funerals was a massive honour. To be able to do that for other families in the RSL here is, it's a huge honour.
Usually a trumpet player, Adam said the duty of becoming the local bugler was thrust upon him about 14 years ago.
I don't even know whether I got asked. I thought of something the other day that every trumpeter is at risk of becoming a bugler. It happened, because if you don't have a bugler, you just get a recording. Having somebody live, even if there's a few bum notes, it's somebody's present, I suppose.
Even when travelling, Adam brings the bugle and plays every day.
So I've played from Darwin Cemetery all the way down to Melbourne as well. So there's 100, and, including our cemeteries here, 104 cemeteries I've played at.
Some of the local graves Adam visits aren't in the best shape, but part of his quest to honour veterans also means cleaning and tending to their graves.
Most of the service graves have got rocks on them, and there might be holes there, so I've started sort of scratching the rocks around and just putting something like a bit of tin in there to cover the hole and put the rocks back on, so at least make them look a bit better. I made myself some screens to screen the rocks out to get rid of the organic matter and the lichen and the moss. That takes quite a while to do, but I'm talking to the local guides, I'll talk to the scouts as well and see whether they'll get involved to try and to clean up more graves here. So there's around about 78 graves of that type. They're looking pretty good now, but I reckon we can make them look better.
To keep track of who he's played for, Adam uses a spreadsheet and usually takes a photo of the headstone so he can find out about the servicemen and women he plays for.
When you look up their records, you do feel closer to them. You get to know them as a person rather than a headstone. And particularly if you find a photo of them on service or a picture of them, it really, putting a face to a name, who that person is really, it's pretty cool. These people gave, you know, a lot. In some cases, they got injured in war to such an extent that it's either killed them, so, you know, being gassed or being severely injured, or they just haven't coped when they came back, so it's giving back to them. and making sure that, well, I suppose if they are around, that they are remembered.
Bugler Adam Farquharson with those beautiful tributes there, ending that report by Jess Scully. And that's AM for today. Thank you for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump is all in on it, but could we drill baby drill our way out of any future oil shocks? We have been mostly self-sufficient in fuel production before, so why not again? Today, Alison Reeve, energy expert from the Grattan Institute, on whether we really could reopen oil refineries across the country. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.